All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. This is the matter of Amanda Wolf and Peter Borschinger. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Case number 18-6091. This is an application for, among other things, the prerogative writ of mandamus and the equitable writ of injunction. With me to my right are Judge Allen, and to my left, Judge Falvey. Will counsel enter their appearances, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Blocker for the petitioner.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christopher Bader for the secretary, and with me at counsel table are Deborah Bernal, Jessica Tanner, and Joan Moriarty, all of the Office of General Counsel.
Thank you. I see Mr. Stitchman is here, and you have another colleague at counsel table?
Eric O'Brien from Civil Office.
All right. Mr. Blocker?
Wait for me.
Welcome. Do you wish to reserve any time?
I'm going to reserve 7 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. Before you get started, what would be wrong with the court ordering the immediate payment of approximately $48,000 to Mr. Staub? Yeah. What would be wrong with the court ordering either from the bench today or very soon afterward an order granting all the relief you're seeking, adding other aspects such as the naming of class counsel and ordering the payment to, I guess it's Ms. Wolf, and at the same time, in accordance with the precedent set by the Supreme Court in Ex Parte Quirin, 1942 opinion, I think it's 63 Supreme Court 1, we'll let you know all our reasons in an opinion several weeks or months from now. Any problem with that?
Can I take those in pieces, Judge? First of all, as to Mr. Staub, I don't think there'd be anything that would prevent this court from ordering the payment to him of the amounts that are
owed. You happen to know, I see Mr. Stitchman here. I think Mr. Stitchman was the lead counsel in the Staub case in April of 2016. Do you know what the status of the payment?
I do.
What is it?
He has not been paid.
$48,000 is in dispute, and he's not been paid. Is that correct?
Correct. His case has been remanded, my understanding, back to the agency to determine what parts of that are co-pays, deductibles, or co-insurance.
No. If you're referring to the decision of the court in April 2016, it was remanded to calculate the precise amount that he was to be paid. There was nothing in there about co-payments or anything else.
Correct. I'm just telling you that.
You do recall also that Secretary Shulkin, in public testimony before the Senate Veterans Committee in June of 2017, undertook to withdraw that his appeal or the Secretary's appeal from that opinion, which was accomplished, I think, by order of the Federal Circuit in June of 2017.
All true, Your Honor. Right. All true. But Mr. Staub.
But he hasn't been paid, has he?
He has not.
That's I don't know why.
I don't, other than what I've told
you. Apart from the, by the way, and don't let me, my questions interfere with your plan of argument. I'm the victim of 45 years of standing where you used to stand, you're standing, and arguing cases, and I know what it's like for counsel to be interrupted by the court. But in all seriousness, what is your position on whether rulemaking is even appropriate given the plain language of the statute involved here?
Rulemaking with respect to co-payments, deductibles, and co-insurance?
Rulemaking with regard to anything.
Yeah.
Emergency room treatment not paid for by a third party, Medicare or an insurance plan of some sort, must be paid by the VA. What is there about that statute that requires any rulemaking whatsoever after the decision of this court in Staub?
I don't think, Your Honor, any rulemaking would be necessary to implement what Congress wanted, which was to make sure veterans were not going to be placed on the hook for the large expenses that are associated with emergency care. So I agree with Your Honor that there would be no need for there to be a subsequent rulemaking. And actually, that would be beneficial to veterans if there were not a subsequent rulemaking, because what happened after the Staub case, after this court said that the regulation that prohibited payment was invalid, it went back to the agency that put claims adjudication on hold for 2 years while it came up with a new regulation, and we're here today because the new regulation is no closer to the mark than the old one.
Right. Approximately how many people were involved? As I recall it, this matter was, or the statute and the regulation were being enforced by the Secretary since at least 2010, after the congressional action in 2009. There were two applications to stay the precedential effect of the court in April of 2016, both rejected unanimously by the court. How many people did the secretary claim would be involved, do you recall? Nearest 100,000.
I don't remember the number. I remember that in the petition, in one of its motions to stay the precedential effect of the Staub petition, they did say there were literally billions of dollars involved that would have to be paid if the statute was interpreted the way Mr. Staub was arguing it should be interpreted. So I don't know what numbers. It was in the hundreds of thousands, is my recollection, Judge Greenberg, but I don't remember the precise number. But
right.
I remember the billions figure because
It's there, yeah. And it was an allegation made in writing by the secretary.
Correct.
How much has been paid to anybody?
Well,
since 2016, when any stay was denied?
Well, I can break that down for you. Between 2016 and 2018, zero, because those claims were put on hold. No adjudications were made. Once the new regulation was put into effect, we don't know how much has been paid, but we did attach to our reply brief, and this is all we really have to go on, a newspaper article reporting that there's been a single payment of $12 since the time that the regulations came in.
The reason I'm bringing up this shocking development is news reports just this past Friday from Minnesota indicating the state of affairs for Mr. Staub, who, as I understand it, is 96 years old. How old is Ms. Wolf?
Ms. Wolf's in her 30s, I believe, Judge.
Anybody know how old Mr. Borschinger is?
Borschinger, I don't know how old Mr. Borschinger is.
I think he's in his 70s, is he not?
Ms. Wolf, though, we've met and I've spoken to, so I know she's youthful.
Well, in any event, the class that you're seeking to be certified would include Mr. Staub, Wolf, Borschinger, and hundreds of thousands of others. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, why don't you proceed with your argument?
Well, I was going to start with may it please the court, but I think we're beyond that. The issue...
No, it's always a better idea to may it please the court.
Well, Judge Greenberg and other judges, may it please the court. The issue that I want to talk to you about today is whether veterans will finally get their benefits that they are entitled to under the Emergency Care Fairness Act. Prior to 2016, if you were a veteran who went to seek emergency care at a non-VA facility, but you had any form of insurance available to you, Medicare, private insurance, anything, the VA didn't reimburse you for any portion of your care. So a veteran like Mr. Staub could be left on the hook for literally thousands of dollars. In Mr. Staub's case, he was left on the hook for $48,000.
Let me interrupt you just for a minute, just so we're clear, or at least I'd like to hear your argument on this. The statutory scheme of Congress has been if the veteran dies at any point during the proceedings, he gets nothing. His estate gets nothing.
That's my understanding, Judge.
Would that also be true here if, God forbid, shall we say, Mr. Staub, age 96, were to die? Would his estate still be entitled to the $48,000? It's on the hook for it.
Yes.
Would, in your view, the same statute that says the veteran, if he dies, doesn't get it, would that apply to this situation?
Well, the statute talks about whether a veteran is liable for it, whether he's responsible for it. So I think the answer would be yes. How probate law and other laws would operate to make somebody responsible for it post-mortem, I don't know the answer to that, Judge. But I mean, from
is it something we ought to consider as a matter of equity?
I think so, yes.
All right.
I wanted to really hone in on two issues today, if I could. One is to talk about the invalidity of the regulation, and second is to talk about whether this court should certify a class. I'm happy to talk about any other issues that are on your mind, but this is where I wanted to start.
At some point, Mr. Blocker, if you could address the concern that is of particular import to me, which is the Secretary frames it as a jurisdictional question. I'm not sure that it actually is jurisdictional, but the question is, because we're here under the All Writs Act doesn't have its own font of jurisdiction, as you know. It must be to protect jurisdiction. And so in a typical writ case where we're talking about agency delay, that's easy to see how that works, because if the agency never renders a final decision, then the court's jurisdiction is thwarted. Can you respond to the Secretary's argument at some point that this is basically a way to accomplish the same thing that could have been done at the Federal Circuit in a direct regulatory challenge using a writ, and that's inappropriate because there are alternative means by which this can come to the court?
Well, let's wipe that away right now, Judge. We'll deal with that first. We do know that the VA makes a jurisdictional argument, and it does have something to do with the All Writs Act. It also relates to the statute, which is 7621, and what powers this court has under 7261, but what powers this court has. But keep in mind, when the Federal Circuit decided the Monk decision and said this court could certify class actions, it didn't rely solely on the All Writs Act. It was also relying on its inherent powers and also the lack of any bar to having class actions be heard. And so we're not just simply proceeding under the All Writs Act, and so the VA's argument's a little bit of a ship's passing in the night argument with us, because we could talk about the All Writs Act, and we certainly do have jurisdiction under that, but there are other bases for our class action petition. Now, as far as whether we're line jumping, you know, whether we're doing something...
No, can I just jump in for a second? I agree with you. We had a lot of class actions recently.
Yes.
So that one I'm on board with. Let's just assume for a minute, let's just take the class action out of it, because I think that just clouds this issue.
Sure.
As I understand what the VA is saying, although I'm sure the VA will say it to me in a minute, or 11 minutes and 10 seconds, but it is, let's presume this is just a single challenge by Ms. Wolf.
Yes.
And she asserts, using the writ device to get before us, that this regulation is impermissible because it is in violation of the statute, okay? I think what the VA is saying is a writ is an inappropriate way to do that, because that could be accomplished as a challenge in a direct appeal. Therefore, the writ is inappropriate. And the Secretary frames it as jurisdictional. I'm not sure that's right. But the idea is the writ appropriate? And that's really the thing that is particularly of concern to me.
Well, I'll embrace your hypothetical and assume Ms. Wolf, on her own, came to this court and asked for a writ. I don't necessarily think that would be improper. But keep in mind, we can remove the class action component from this, but that is an important element. There are really, at the end of the day, there are two ways, other than a writ, that the issue of the validity of the regulation could get before a court. One is on a direct review, as the VA points out, to the Federal Circuit. But this court has powers under 7261. If you entertained a direct appeal, as you did in Mr. Stubb's case, you would invalidate a regulation. That's 7261A3. It allows you to invalidate a regulation. There's no reason that using a writ, you can't use the exact same powers under 7261 through the writ to invalidate the regulation, even if it was only Ms. Wolf. But again,
And I am with you 100%, as I'm going to ask the VA, the argument that the 7261 powers don't apply in the context of writ doesn't make any sense, because that happens. Right. That's the only powers we have.
Right.
And so, but the point is, I think the better way to, if I were going to be representing the Secretary and we're going to be arguing this, what I would have said is not that it's a jurisdictional issue, but that the requirements, because the writ is an extraordinary device, if there is an alternative means available by which this could get to the court, that we won't use the extraordinary writ of mandamus. And I think the Secretary's argument is, Ms. Wolf can challenge this before the agency, get a final board decision, then it'll be before us, and we can strike the regulation down.
The problem with that, Judge Allen, is it could be an adequate remedy as to Ms. Wolf, who's in her 30s and can wait out the 5 years it's going to take to get up back up to this court. What about all, but we're in the context of a class action, what about all the veterans who are going to be affected during the 5 years the first veteran has to struggle to get back up to this court to have the regulation be adjudicated and invalidated? In the meantime, what you're going to have is 5 years worth of denials. There's no doubt, the Secretary isn't disputing that the VA, the department has to apply the regulation as written. So you're going to have 5 years of useless proceedings with veterans losing their rights. If they don't take appeals, they're going to lose their rights forever. And the reason that this isn't an adequate alternative remedy has a lot to do with the class, because Ms. Wolf herself might be able to wait it out because she's not in her 90s, she's in her 30s, and this is $2,000 to her, it's not $48,000, maybe she could weather the storm. But end of the day, asking veterans to wait 5 years while this regulation remains on the books doesn't make any sense. And whether you use the writ or 7261A3 or, you know, any other means, it should be adjudicated now so veterans aren't losing their rights.
This is also against the backdrop of Mr. Staub.
Correct.
3 years, nothing's happened, not a dollar. Right.
And as I said, the VA put...
What do we have to do?
And that's where we're at, Judge Greenberg. I mean, we think it's time for this statute to be enforced the way it was written, which is the VA is supposed to be the secondary payer, not veterans. The way the statute ends up, the way the regulations ends up is before 2016 under Staub, before Staub was decided, if you had any form of insurance, you got zero. Under the new regulation, you're in exactly the same place if you're a veteran. There is no difference between the pre-Staub regime and the post-Staub regime. It is still that Ms. Wolf is not getting, her insurance company is going to pay, but she's not getting co-payments, deductibles, or co-insurance. And so everything that is potentially her responsibility under her insurance contract is going to fall under her. And look, she had an appendicitis. She had no choice in whether to spend these dollars. And that's the reason that Congress passed this, so that veterans didn't have the circumstance where they would have to spend money out of their own pocket, had absolutely no choice about whether to do it, but now it's in dire financial straits.
And I think your day job is in the insurance world, I think. And are you aware of any, and I know you probably don't do medical insurance, I'm guessing, but are you aware of any other thing that could be a payment under a medical insurance policy besides a co-payment, co-insurance, or deductible?
Not that I am aware of. The most common arrangement, Judge Allen, would be if you have some form of insurance, and it's not an HMO, your possibilities are there's going to be a co-payment. That's the small fee when you go to the doctor's office or when you go to an emergency room. There can be a deductible that can be, you know, hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, and then there can be coinsurance if you have some sort of PPO type arrangement where you pay a percentage of your care. But again, you know, coinsurance, we're now talking about the veteran paying for a percentage of their care, even though the whole purpose of the Emergency Care Fairness Act was to make sure that didn't happen. But to answer your question directly, I am not aware of any other form of payment that somebody in a PPO-type arrangement would have, in a HMO arrangement, I think there would only be copays, and then everything else would be taken care of.
I just wanted to make sure, because we hadn't been able to find one either, which actually leads me to wonder what the $12 reimbursement was for.
I actually have the same question. I'm sure the secretary's lawyers will clear that up. But and again, all we had to go on was the newspaper article. So I don't know if they've paid more than that. Maybe they're going to get up and say they've paid millions of dollars. I don't know. But yeah, it's hard to imagine what was being paid. Because everything else would be taken care of by copays, deductibles, and coinsurance. So I think since I only have 4 minutes left, I'm going to skip to the class certification issues because...
relax. If you need more time to make your argument, we've intruded on your time.
Yeah, no.
Certainly I have, so we'll add time to it. So yeah. Keep going.
What you're calling intrusion, I call conversation. So that's fine with me, Judge. I just want to talk about the class because the VA's brief makes what I view as a false dispute or raises a false dispute about the size of the class. The VA talks about a, quote, broader class and a narrower class. And I'm going to make this issue very easy for you, which is I don't think it matters which of those classes that you certify, but I'm going to explain to you why we think you should certify the broader class. And the reason I don't think it makes any difference is I think these may be exactly the same sets at the end of the day, but I'm going to explain to you why you can certify either class. The narrower class, what VA is calling the narrower class, is veterans whose claims were denied solely on the grounds that the amounts constitute deductibles or coinsurance. So the only reason their claim was denied was that ground. And for that class, that so-called narrower class, they're conceding everything other than typicality and adequacy. Okay, so there's, I'm not going to say anything else about that other than we're down to typicality and adequacy. Now, the only objection the VA has on typicality and adequacy grounds for the narrower class is they say, well, Ms. Wolf isn't typical because there might, when her case goes back down, there might be some other defense, hypothetically, that could be raised that would make, you know, the fact that it's deductibles, co-payments, or co-insurance irrelevant. So the example, I guess, would be if for some reason it was determined there was an emergency care, it didn't qualify as emergency care. But the VA's argument as to Ms. Wolf's circumstance is wholly speculative. They are not giving this court any reason to believe. They are not articulating any ground on which there might be some other reason that Ms. Wolf's claim would be denied. And the case law is crystal clear, and they cite the Beck case on page 45 of their brief, and so you can look and see this. But a defendant, in order to defeat typicality and adequacy on the grounds of some unique defense, has to show some evidentiary basis for that. Otherwise, what you'd have is defendants coming in, like we think the VA is doing, frankly, and just drumming up the possibility of a defense, and that's not sufficient to defeat typicality or adequacy. So when you wipe those away, there's no impediment to certifying what the VA is calling the narrower class. But I'm going to tell you, we believe you should certify the broader class, what the VA is calling the broader class, which is what we call the proposed class, which is on page 22 of our amended petition, which is all veterans who've been denied reimbursement for deductibles and coinsurance for any emergency care. And the difference between the two classes is it would include somebody whose claim was denied both because it was, say, coinsurance and was determined not to be emergency care. And the reason you should certify that broader class is the person who loses on both those grounds is in really in a dilemma, because if they're not part of this class, they don't have an incentive to take on the issue of whether this was truly emergency care, because they know the issue about whether it's a copayment or whether it's a copayment or it's deductible or insurance, coinsurance, is not going to help them. Because at the end of the day, even if it is emergency, they're going to lose, and they're going to make a decision not to appeal, and it would be a reasonable decision not to appeal. But the reason to certify the broader class is to make the invalidation of the regulation applicable, have those proceedings re-adjudicated as well, so that those claimants can make a decision, those veterans can decide, okay, now we're down to just the issue of whether it's emergency care. I'm going to decide whether I've got a realistic chance of prevailing on that issue, but I don't have the legal impediment of the regulation that's at issue here. So we think you should certify here the broader class, the one that would include anybody who's had their claim denied on the grounds that it's deductible or coinsurance, regardless of what other grounds the VA articulated for their decision.
Just a minute. Add 5 minutes, please. Keep going.
So I would suggest that Your Honors should certify the broader class. They make the same arguments about typicality and adequacy as to the broader class that they do as to the narrower class. And so, again, they cannot defeat class certification by raising a hypothetical defense without any evidentiary basis. They haven't articulated any grounds in their brief to, or any reason to believe, even, that there's some unique circumstance to Ms. Wolf that would result in the denial of her claim other than the regulation itself. So we would encourage the court to, and we think the appropriate outcome here is to certify the broader class that we have articulated, and it's listed on page 22 of our petition.
Let me ask you this. Sorry.
I want to go back. So if you've got class questions.
Yes, on the class issue, are you offering yourself as lead or class counsel should the court certify the class?
Together with Mr. Stichman and NVLSP. You can look at the materials we attach as exhibits A, B, and C, and you can see that this is a team that's dealt with class actions quite a bit.
All right. So, is there anything else we should know that occurs frequently in Article III court situations where class certification is sought? We have, apart from the issues surrounding Rule 23.
No, I think if this was a claim that had been brought in district court, in a regular court outside of the veterans arena, I think this would be the prototype of the sort of claim that you would certify as a class. It affects a wide swath of individuals in a uniform way, and invalidating the regulation will have a uniform effect on everybody in the class. I'm sorry, Judge Falvey, did...
I want to go back to the assertion you made, prompted by Judge Greenberg, that rulemaking was unnecessary here with the statute. The statute doesn't define copay, is that right?
That's true.
Nor does it define similar payments.
It's actually similar payment, singular, but it doesn't define that.
Doesn't define that. So there are gaps there to be filled. What is meant by copay? What is meant by similar payment? If similar payment does not equal deductibles or coinsurance, what does it mean?
Well, two things. Let me just quibble with something you said. I don't think there are gaps to be filled here. When you're interpreting the statute, you're going to look at the statute in its entirety. We have directed our attack at a regulation that was implemented under 1725 C4D, but you wouldn't interpret that, see whether that regulation is consistent with the statute, unless you also looked at C25, C4, A, B, and C. And if you look at C25, A, B, and C, as we point out in our brief, we think that compels the outcome that copayment had to be a standalone item, that it was intended to be a small fixed item, not to sweep in every form of cost sharing. So I don't think there's a, quote, gap to fill. But to answer your question about whether there is a definition, there is no definition. But what a similar payment was meant to be, that it's evident from the other sections of the statute that I'm talking about, was something like a copayment, but just given some other label. So the VA and Ms. Wolf agree on this point, that the term or similar payment was intended to afford regulatory flexibility. So insurance company A might call it copayment. Insurance company B might call it something else, dream up a name. But the idea was to use the words or similar payment to capture the other things that an insurance company might call copayment, and not to sweep in other things. And we've pointed out in our brief that there are other veteran statutes, like 1729.83, which use both of the terms when they meant both of the terms. So 1729.83 relates to payments for services for disability. And it specifically says that the Veterans Administration can deduct from their payment co-payments and deductibles, but it says both. It doesn't refer to the term or similar payment. So the tenor of both the statute itself, the entire statute itself, and other veteran statutes, it's such that copayment was meant to be a standalone item. And keep in mind that it's phrased in the singular. It's not copayment or other similar payments, you know, which theoretically, I suppose, could have referred to something broader, but it's payment in the singular, which means it's something identical to a copayment.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm out of time. I wanted to save 7 minutes for rebuttal, so I'm going to sit back down, but thanks.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Bader?
I understand two of you will be arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. I will be handling the claim of Ms. Wolf, and my co-counsel, Deborah Bernal, will be addressing the claim of Mr. Borschinger, or Borschinger.
Will you each be dealing with the class issue? Or?
Yes, we can each touch on the class issues as they pertain to each petitioner. They're a little bit different as to each one.
Why shouldn't the court order you today to pay Mr. Staub $48,000?
Your Honor, that's a good question, and I'm glad you asked. I do have an update on the claim of Mr. Staub. It is not true that he has been paid nothing. For his 2011 episodes of emergency care, he went to the hospital in December 2010 for a heart attack and then went back to the hospital in January of the next year because he had a stroke. And based on those claims, VA paid almost $2,500 for emergency care physicians and ambulance fees. The bulk of that $48,000 figure he has cited seems to be costs that stemmed from his two stays at a private nursing home. After he was discharged from the hospital, he went to go stay with his wife, who was staying at a local private nursing home. And it appears he wanted to stay there and incurred some fees for doing so, but VA is not permitted to reimburse those costs because they aren't emergency care. In a recent board decision, I believe it was issued on March 21st, the one that my opponent referred to, the board found that Mr. Staub could be reimbursed for the two episodes of emergency care, could not be reimbursed for the stays at the nursing home, and then there was a separate surgery he had on his heart that was pre-planned. It wasn't emergency, and they denied.
Can you tell us, this is the first we're hearing of it, you may not remember, but I've asked three times since 2016 counsel in arguments before, has he been paid, meaning the $48,000? Two people didn't know, and one said, yes, he had been paid. When did all this payment that you're talking about occur?
I am not sure when these payments occurred. This is stuff that we've gathered from VHA as we were preparing for today and responding to congressional inquiries about Mr. Staub's case. I don't know when those payments occurred, but they would have been made most likely direct to the provider. So maybe that Mr. Staub just didn't know that they were made.
But the emergency, which took Mr. Staub in the first place and perhaps in the second place to the emergency room, did the what you're now describing as, what is it, nursing home care, did they relate to those emergency room episodes?
He decided to go to those private nursing homes after each episode of emergency care. In fact, he went to the hospital. I think he was on his way to visit his wife, actually, at the nursing home. He had a heart attack, went to the hospital, was discharged from there, decided to go to the nursing home to be with her during his recuperation, and then had a stroke while he was at that nursing home, was taken back to the same private hospital, and then spent, I think, almost 6 months at the beginning of 2011 in that nursing home. And so the board decided that he should be reimbursed, subject to the cost share exclusion, for the time he was in the hospital, but not for the time at the private nursing home.
Well, I'm looking at our opinion of April 2016, and correct me if I'm wrong, if the court was wrong, because we've never been told before today what you're telling us today. VA denied the appellant's claims for reimbursement of the cost of his medical care from one, Centra Care Laboratory Services between April 18, 2011 and June 24, 2011, two, St. Cloud Hospital between December 28, 2010 and March 3, 2011, three, St. Benedict's Center between January 7, 2011 and April 15, 2011. The cost of this care has been estimated by the appellant to be approximately $48,000.
So it appears that
you didn't contest any of this in the case in April of 2016.
It may well be that these payments came after that time while we were processing the claims. But what we do know is that we have paid almost $2,500 as part of Mr. Staub's emergency care. And I think that this goes to a very interesting point that petitioner's counsel makes. He says that if VA interprets Section 1725C4D in the way that it does in its regulation, that the other changes made in the Emergency Care Fairness Act would be superfluous. That is, the only thing that an insured veteran could owe after their private health insurance or their government insurance pays would be a cost share, or some kind of cost share, a copayment, deductible, or coinsurance. But that's simply not true. And in fact, it's not true for Mr. Staub and for Mr. Borschinger specifically. So if you have, for example, Mr. Staub had Medicare Part A, he didn't have Parts B or D. When he went to the hospital in 2017 for a different episode of emergency care, VA actually paid charges that were not going to be covered under Medicare Part A, anesthesia, radiology, the ambulance charges. So it actually was advantageous for Mr. Staub to have VA step in and be the secondary payer in that instance. The same thing happened with Mr. Borschinger. He had 14 claims generated as part of his emergency care. VA paid on 13 of them, totaling over $4,000, because Medicare Part A, which Mr. Borschinger had, generally only covers the facility fees for the hospital. So it's simply untrue that veterans gain no advantage from having VA be a secondary payer in these sorts of instances. It really depends on...
So it's not, just to be clear, it's not true then the information that's appeared in the newspapers concerning only $12 being reimbursed?
It is not true, Your Honor. That statement was referring to an ancillary charge for one veteran. It wasn't Mr. Staub. It wasn't Mr. Borschinger.
Why should we believe you? Not that you're pulling anything, a fast, sharp practice on the court, but why should we believe what you're saying? What's the source of all this information that the court is hearing for the first time in May 2019? We ruled in April 2016. The secretary didn't make any of these arguments ever when he applied for a stay of the precedential effect of that opinion, when he took the appeal to the Federal Circuit, and a year later when he abandoned the appeal under pressure from the senators before whom he was testifying. He never said any of this. Where'd you get this information from?
Well, Your Honor, the...
Why should we believe it?
The information...
I believe you believe it, or you wouldn't be standing before us making the argument. But where'd you get this information from?
Your Honor, the information with respect to Mr. Staub was collected by our healthcare law group in the Office of General Counsel working with VHA. And they're the ones that have access to this information because they're processing the claims.
Where's the paperwork? Why didn't you submit it to us?
Well, Your Honor, that's sort of the... I think that goes to a really important part of this case as a whole, is that we're here on a writ proceeding. You don't have a record before you. And so the record is fact poor. I'll admit that. But I don't think that that...
We had a record in April 2016. This wasn't part of it.
That is true, Your Honor.
Don't you think the secretary has an obligation to be fair to the court, present the facts to the court? Don't you have a statutory obligation? Doesn't the Board of Veterans Appeals have a statutory obligation to put everything together so that the court can properly review it?
It does.
Wouldn't it have been appropriate, whether it's in the context of a writ or in the context of a contempt proceeding,
Your Honor,
to supply us with this information?
Your Honor, it is true that the Secretary takes very seriously his duty to be candid to the court. I'm not sure why in April 2016 certain facts were available to VA and the parties that perhaps are available to us now. But I will say, going back to the $12 charge in the news article, so we know for a fact that that is not true. As I've just explained, Mr. Staub has had payments made on his behalf, almost $2,500, Mr. Borschinger over $4,000. So we know for a fact that's not true. Unfortunately, after the claims, after these reimbursement claims were released for processing after the rulemaking post-Staub, we weren't able to track those payments separately. So we don't have some sort of global figure as to what's been paid since Staub.
Could I ask one question that is sort of in the background for me? and it was just alluded to by you now, which is why I'm going to follow up on it. Exactly what was the theory, if you know, of the VA to, after having sought a stay of the Staub decision and been denied, to simply not adjudicate any claims under the court's decision? I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, that was not your decision to make.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. My co-counsel can actually speak more to those issues, but put very briefly, once the partial health insurance bar was removed, so before that time, the processing for these claims was somewhat simple. If there was...
Well, can I just stop you for a second? Right, even the way you just phrased that, and I'm not criticizing you personally, once the partial bar was removed, that's not what the court did.
Right.
The court told the secretary, the executive branch of government, authoritatively what the statute meant.
True.
And so the VA disagreed with that. But your ability to follow the law was not the VA's, and when I use you, I am just, you happen to be the person standing there. It was not the VA's choice to make whether to follow the law. And this may seem irrelevant, but it actually goes for me very much to the need for an extraordinary writ. As I was discussing with Mr. Blocker, I take the extraordinariness, if that's a word, of the writ seriously. But when I look back, so one of my law clerks in a non-legalistic way described the All Writs Act essentially as a tool to out-weasel the weasels, right? In other words, that the court can use to prevent problems like this. And the fact that for 2 years the VA acted as if what we said was the law was not the law suggests to me that the need for an extraordinary writ is very high. And I want to make that very clear so that you can actually respond to that directly.
Of course, Your Honor. So there, as you pointed out earlier, and I think this is an astute observation, the Secretary's arguments about the writ portion, the sort of the propriety of the writ, are not really jurisdictional. You're absolutely right there. It's about the elements of the writ that you have to satisfy. But those elements are still very important. So we know that Ms. Wolf can obtain direct review of this regulation by appealing to the court after she receives, assuming she receives an adverse board decision. That alone deprives her of the right to seek a writ, because one of the most important requirements, and one that she largely ignores in her pleadings, is that you must not be able to get the relief you're seeking in a writ through an ordinary appeal. The Supreme Court has said that time and again. It's not a useless act to appeal through the administrative process. It's a cornerstone feature of Title 38 that veterans get an administrative appeal where their claims are reviewed and the facts and the law are developed. And moreover, I wanted to speak to a point you raised earlier, which I think is also fair. The Secretary's argument is not that this court lacks authority under Section 7261 to invalidate a regulation.
And I'm really interested in those points, but I want to go back and if the Secretary doesn't have a position, that's fine. I just need you to tell me that. I need to understand the Secretary's logic in, for 2 years, refusing to adjudicate any claims. Now, I understand you say, you again, the Secretary, says they needed to engage in rulemaking. Perhaps Judge Falvey's questions directed at the point that rulemaking might have been appropriate. However, at the time, you knew what the statute meant. We had authoritatively said it. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Mr. Blocker is correct that during that two-year period, just nothing was reimbursed.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. So the Secretary had to engage in rulemaking to set, if you look at Section 1725C, it tells the Secretary to set the maximum amount payable for this emergency care, and then at the end it creates that cost share exception to whatever that maximum amount payable is going to be.
You're talking about the regulation?
No, the statute, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
So the Secretary had to develop those rates through a rulemaking process. It then had to essentially create the mechanisms in the offices of community care that are at the VA medical centers across the country to adjudicate these claims. Because remember, before this, the adjudication process for these claims was, as I said, relatively simple. So that those protocols, that structure had to be put in place before we could properly adjudicate the claims. And that's why the delay occurred.
I'll just tell you that from my perspective, this, it's deeply troubling, and it goes to the need for a writ, because the fact that something is complicated and VA didn't have procedures in place because it was misinterpreting what the law was, it seems to me there's a pretty strong argument that that can't possibly be used as a justification then for continuing for 2 years to not follow the law. So, you know, this is a concern to me. In any event, you were talking about 7261 and its powers.
I was, although I would say that it is certainly true that cases of unreasonable delay are worthy of a writ from this court to compel action. But remember, that's not what Ms. Wolf is asking for here. She vaguely alludes to the idea that on average it takes 5 years to get a board decision, but she has offered no evidence whatsoever that there's delay in her case. In fact, she was issued a statement of the case in late March, and she can pursue an appeal to the board if she likes soon after that.
Well, what about the 200 or 300,000 people that you complained about would be clogging the system as of April 2016?
Your Honor, each veteran who participates in the benefit system has an obligation to appeal an adverse decision. And I think it's especially troubling in petitioner's submissions that she wants to deploy class relief to end run around the rule of finality of judgments.
So let me just, and again, I understand why you're making the argument you do. I think you are factually undercut by what your co-counsel is going to be discussing with me in a moment, because as far as I know, even to this day, and maybe your co-counsel will tell me I'm wrong, but certainly as of relatively recently, the VA is telling veterans, you are not subject to any reimbursement at all if you have any health insurance.
Your Honor, actually, I think that goes to my point. We're perfectly happy for the court to recognize that the way that Petitioner Borschinger has framed his argument, that is, people who were told an incorrect statement of the law and then were chilled from exercising their appellate rights, I think that's a perfect example of the place where the writ is best used, because it removes a procedural impediment to the court's exercise of its appellate jurisdiction in due course. But remember, Ms. Wolf is not asking for that. She says, there may be delay in my case, so you should get to the merits anyway. But that is the very purpose of appeals, so she can't deploy a writ to get there.
But so what about some of the law that's out there, I mean, outside of our court, in the general writ context? And there isn't a lot of it, because there's not a lot of these writs overall, that suggests that that sort of futility is something that can be taken into account. And what I mean by that is, at the end of the day, in terms of the challenge to this regulation, as I understand it, we know what the board's answer has to be, right?
It is unlikely that that answer will change.
Is there a means by which, because this is actually quite important to me, is there a means by which the board can decline to enforce a regulation of the secretary or strike it down? As I understand it, the board is bound by that.
No, yeah, my response to Your Honor's question is solely that there could be further factual development.
Right, but on the question of the validity of the regulation,
the board would have to follow the
regulation. The board is going to, right, so we know for certain, and the only uncertainty is how much time it takes from now until the board makes that decision.
That is true, although I will say that there's no inevitability exception to the court's exercise of its writ power. Indeed, that would completely write out of the Supreme Court's test the requirement that you not have an adequate alternative means. As we noted in our brief, the Roche case from the Supreme Court, I think, is particularly instructive. They have a passage talking about the idea that when Congress created systems of appellate review, as they did in the VJRA in 1988 for this court, they anticipated that delay would be a part of the proceedings. And yet, they said only final judgments, or in this case, final adverse decisions of the board would be reviewable. So it is true that there is delay, but that's simply part of the system. I also wanted to respond, Your Honor, to a point that I think is very important for purposes of the court's exercise of its jurisdiction or its authority under the All Writs Act. Counsel suggested that the basis for the court's exercise or deployment of the writ here could be Rule 23, it could be the VJRA itself, the court's inherent authority, the ruling in Monk. All of those sources.
What about the Constitution? Our inherent authority as a court. What do we need the All Writs Act?
Your Honor,
to entertain an application for what heretofore had been known as a prerogative writ of mandamus or the writ of injunction, enjoining the secretary from refusing to make the payment or from refusing to give notice, for example, to an entire class?
Your Honor, I...
Why do we... No, you add two more minutes.
So the...
What about our inherent power? Henderson, Justice Alito, we're acting as if we were an Article III court reviewing the determinations or absence of determination of an administrative agency.
Your Honor, the court's inherent authority, its power under Rule 23 to grant aggregate relief, those powers are broad. But the thing to remember is that broad remedial power doesn't affect the court's jurisdiction to award relief in the first place. So that's the Secretary's position here, is that if there was a basis for granting a writ here, if Ms. Wolf actually lacked an adequate alternative means, then perhaps aggregate relief would be appropriate, but she conflates the two questions.
Anything else? Thank you. Do you have anything more to argue?
I would just briefly summarize, Your Honor, if I may.
Go right ahead.
So the Secretary asks that you dismiss the petition as it doesn't state a claim for a writ. The Secretary would also ask that if you find that you do have authority to issue a writ in this case, that you uphold the Secretary's regulation as it represents a reasonable construction of the Congress's instruction to exclude from reimbursement co-payments, but also similar payments that a veteran might owe under a health plan contract.
Do you dispute what counsel said about the word payment versus payments?
I do. I think that that is a distinction without a difference here. Congress instructed VA to exclude from reimbursement co-payments or similar, it says a co-payment or similar payment that the veteran owes a third party or for which a veteran is responsible under a health plan contract. So
what did the Secretary do in its rulemaking to attend to that? Assuming you even had the need, keep going, add some more time, two more minutes. Assuming you even had the authority to make a rule that this wasn't a self-executing statute.
Your Honor, it's a very good question, and I think that the way petitioners presented the claim is slightly misleading. This regulation, so we know that the ECFA was passed by Congress in 2009, signed into law in 2010. This regulation was promulgated in 2012. Without comment or objection from anyone. And the regulation originally said that VA would exclude from reimbursement co-payments or deductibles. The only thing that the Secretary did in 2018 in its interim final rulemaking is to add the word co-insurance to that regulation. But that was consistent with VA's existing practice. Again,
what does it mean, co-insurance?
Co-insurance is...
Is it defined in the rule?
I don't believe it's defined.
Of course it isn't. What does it mean?
Your Honor, those terms...
Where's the statutory authority to add the concept of co-insurance, whatever that is?
Your Honor, Congress instructed VA to determine what was similar to a co-payment that a veteran might owe under a private health insurance contract.
No, co-payment or similar payment. Everybody knows when you go into a hospital's emergency room situation, those tend to be rather modest amounts, $20, $200, so on and so forth. That's common experience. In the case of Ms. Wolf, this $2,400 coinsurance, I have no idea what that means, where it came from. Neither does the Secretary. That's why we're struggling here with a matter of statutory construction, and that's why we're asking you on behalf of the secretary to tell us, where did you get this notion that you were entitled, the secretary was entitled to put this other kind of coinsurance?
So if there's one thing we take away from today, it's that the parties disagree about the meaning of the word similar, that in petitioner's view, it has a quantitative sense, whereas the secretary submits that it has a qualitative sense. That is, we're looking for things that serve a similar function to copayments. The statute itself actually says any copayment or similar payment, and so I would suggest that the absence of the S at the end of the word payment doesn't actually mean that we were only looking for one other.
Well, what did the secretary do to inform himself in the rulemaking process as to the common everyday understanding of these payments in the world of hospitals or emergency rooms?
Your Honor, the secretary looked to practices of the health insurance industry and learned that cost-sharing measures like copayments, deductibles, and coinsurance are often associated together in health plan contracts. Notably, the secretary did not include in his regulation things like premiums. Even though those are costs that a veteran owes under a private health insurance contract, they're not similar to copayments, deductibles, and coinsurance because they're not cost-sharing.
Has anybody tried to get reimbursed for a premium for a health?
I don't think so, but I mean to say that
really
costs
is quite different, isn't it? With the presiding judge's permission, could I ask you one question? Because I don't understand. You said that the regulation originally existed from 2012. Is that right?
True.
In that period of time, why would, if VA's position at the time, pre-Staub, was that if you have any private insurance, you don't get reimbursement at all, why would they have made that regulation?
It's a good question, Your Honor. And actually,
thank you.
In the 2018 interim final rulemaking, if you look at the comments, VA recognized that prior to the ECFA, the partial health insurance bar essentially spelled the doom for all reimbursement claims where there was other health insurance. Nevertheless, the secretary had an instruction to exclude from reimbursement copayments or similar payments, so he implemented a regulation to do that. In the 2018 rulemaking.
So then, though, but at the time then, so the secretary went, I don't mean this to sound as incredulous as it sounds, but the secretary went through all the hoops of formal rulemaking to adopt a rule to exclude something that by the secretary's reading of the statute could never be applied.
Your Honor, I don't believe that the secretary was at liberty to ignore Congress's instruction in 1724C4D. So we implemented it.
Did that ever make the secretary think that maybe its understanding of the statute was entirely wrong? That Congress directed the agency to expend its resources to do something that could never happen?
The court's reading of the statute in Staub, where they specifically pointed out, you know, this cost share exclusion doesn't make any sense if partial health insurance is sufficient to defeat the claim. That's exactly right.
So then why then did the secretary add to the regulation that we're considering today, or that we may be considering today, that's at Ms. Wolf's petition, why did it decide to add coinsurance and it didn't have it before?
That was simply consistent with its practice. If you look at the comments to the rulemaking,
I don't understand that. It was consistent with its practice. What its practice would have never been to reimburse anything prior to Staub. And then after Staub, its practice was, I'm not going to reimburse anything because even though I know what the law is, I am going to create regulations. Then it creates a regulation. It adds to the regulation a new term, coinsurance, that it did not have in the 2012 regulation. Why did it do that?
Because coinsurance is exactly like deductibles and copayments.
Then why wasn't it there before? I mean, in other words, what changed for the secretary went through rulemaking in 2012, then went through rulemaking in, what was it, 2018, basically. It adopted the post-Staub rule and added a new term. And that term is the big term, right? Of all of these things, although deductibles can be large, coinsurance, the way it tends to work is it's a percentage, right? Mm-hmm. So as opposed to a copayment where I take a $20 bill out of my pocket and I know that it's always going to be $20, hypothetically, if my co-insurance is 20%, then I might end up taking lots of $20 bills out of my pocket, right? So the secretary added that. And we, if we reach the merits, we have to determine, for example, whether that is actually, because that's actually what Ms. Wolf has, is co-insurance here. We then have to figure out whether that's permissible. And it does seem potentially odd that it wasn't there before and then is added after the Staub decision, in which, of course, the secretary at the time complained was going to cost billions of dollars.
If you read the comments to the interim final rulemaking, you'll see that the secretary recognized that the cost share exclusion might gain new salience after the removal of the partial health insurance bar. And so the secretary updated the regulation, 1710.05A5, to reflect his understanding that coinsurance could be qualitatively related to deductibles and copayments.
So you basically, and again, you, the secretary, you took the opportunity to do everything you could to make the payment to veterans as low as possible.
I disagree. So the...
Well, by adding coinsurance, you will have to agree that simply as a matter of insurance math, the payment to veterans will be dramatically less.
The key to remember here, Your Honor, that is true, that coinsurance can often represent a very large figure that veterans will owe under their health plan contract. Absolutely. But the thing to remember here is that we're talking about emergency care for non-service-connected conditions being given in non-VA hospitals. So if Ms. Wolf had a service-connected injury, it would have been treated for...
But Congress said they get that.
That's
right.
Congress
said they get that, right?
Congress said they get that subject to the cost-share exclusion.
Which you have interpreted to exclude now, after Staub, a decision that the secretary vehemently disagreed with at the time, right?
Said it was wrongly decided.
The secretary has added to the list of exclusions or things that you will not reimburse a something that is a large dollar amount for most people that wasn't there before. So I'm struggling with how that can be a permissible interpretation of this, because you've sort of changed what your list is. And you told me that you did the 2012 because Congress commanded you to do it. So I'm going to take you at your word and say that the secretary then tried to do a good job. And so what I'm struggling with is why adding coinsurance after Staub to this list that existed pre-Staub, even if it was never used, is permissible, given that it keeps more things from being reimbursed to veterans.
It is true. So the secretary stands on the qualitative comparison that he draws between those three types of payments as the justification for why they should all be excluded under the statute. I think it's also important to remember that, you know, not only is this non-service connected conditions, emergency care to non-VA hospital, it's also important to remember that veterans are granted many, many benefits as part of their private health insurance or government-sponsored health care that VA had no part in negotiating or drafting. And it's...
What does that mean? Granted by Congress? You mean?
No, I mean that as part of their private health plans or, say, their Medicare coverage, they get to go to their own doctors. They get to go to get care that they is covered under those plans. And VA had no part in negotiating those health...
What difference does it make? Congress passed a law.
Well,
if you go to an emergency room, you're entitled to reimbursement. That's what we ruled in Staub.
Interesting.
No exceptions.
Your Honor, unfortunately, there is one exception that Congress added during the ECFA. No one talked about it in their statements on the floor, but Congress added for the first time to this statute the cost share exclusion. They expanded the definition of emergency treatment. They removed the partial health insurance bar, but they also added for the very first time the cost share exclusion, which is an eminently reasonable thing to do.
This is the co-payment.
The co-payment.
No. The co-payment, not this co-insurance. Congress didn't add co-insurance. Co-payment, $20, not $20,000 or $48,000. This is an important concept.
Congress didn't put that in. You people put it in.
When faced with the instruction to exclude from reimbursement copayments or things similar to copayments?
That's not what the statute says. Similar to?
It says any copayment or similar payment that the veteran owes a third party or for which a veteran is responsible under a health plan contract. So it directs the secretary to look at health plan contracts and decide what payments under those could be similar to copayments. And so that's what the secretary did. He drew the qualitative comparison. And as Judge Falvey's questions pointed out, there really is no basis for the quantitative comparison that petitioner's counsel draws. He can't point to even one other kind of thing that is a copayment by another name. And he can't point to a single regulation, statute, or even a private health plan that talks about things that are similar in dollar amount to copayments but aren't called copayments. Your Honor, I see I've run out of time. May I briefly conclude?
Go ahead.
Your Honor, as I've explained today, we ask that the court dismiss the amended petition because it doesn't satisfy the requirements for the extraordinary relief for a writ. We also ask that if the court finds that it can issue a writ, that it uphold the Secretary's regulation, which is a reasonable construction of Congress's command to exclude copayments and similar payments. And finally, if the court decides that it can issue a writ and that the regulation is invalid, the Secretary asks that you issue only a precedential decision because that will accord exactly the same relief to all affected veterans as a class action might.
Well, what, is that true? What did you do with Staub after we issued a precedential opinion that you objected to, that you made a two motions to stay the precedential effect? This is 2016. And by the way, counsel applied under the Equal Access to Justice Act for a fee, which the secretary did not contest, meaning that they had applied within the 30-day requirement and that the secretary's position was not substantially justified. You didn't even argue with the application for a fee in Staub. How do you square that?
After we had conceded the merits in Staub, we would have had no grounds to say that our position was substantially justified for the purposes of the EJ application. So, Your Honors, as I've stated, even if you should reach the class portion of this writ, we ask that you issue only a precedential decision, as that will accord the same relief to all affected veterans that a class action might. And I will cede the remainder of my time to my co-counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Blocker, you're going to reply to both. Is that it? All right.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Bernal, and I'm representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Borsinger's petition identified problems in VA's emergency care reimbursement system that the Secretary was previously unaware of. When VA revised its regulations to implement the court's decision in Staub, it did not update its notification templates for its letters or its information technology software to reflect the revised reimbursement eligibility criteria, and therefore VA correspondence contained erroneous information advising veterans that their claims could not be granted if they had whole or partial other health insurance.
Has that all been resolved now?
It has, Your Honor. The Secretary is taking corrective action to remedy...
Taking or has taken? What do the letters say now?
Yeah, if a letter went out today, what would it say?
Where is it? Do you have it with you? What's today's letter look like?
Your Honor, I don't have any letters.
Why not?
Well, Your Honor, the letter, because there's no uniform letter.
No uniform letter?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the
corrective action was to take care of the uniform letter that was incorrect.
Well, Your Honor, there wasn't a uniform action that occurred here. If you look at Dr. Matthews' declaration, as noted, to provide the relief that was sought in the petition, the Secretary had to divide the claimants here into three separate categories. Mr. Borsinger himself is only a member of the Category A group, people who were denied.
Could I just stop you and ask a really simple question? And the answer to this has got to be either yes, no, or I don't know, okay? Is the VA sending correct information to veterans today about whether or not having a health insurance policy categorically excludes them from reimbursement?
Yes, Your Honor.
They are, it's all correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the templates have been corrected. That was corrected on February 14th, 2019. So anything going forward past that point is a corrected letter.
So then I don't understand. That's excellent. I don't understand then your answer to Judge Greenberg's question. Because if there are templates that are corrected, if you have a template, that sounds to me, I don't know how to say it without being repetitive.
It's a form letter.
It's a form letter, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The template has been corrected going forward, but we still had to correct the problem identified in Mr. Borchinger's petition, which
you mean for the people who got bad notice in the past?
Yes, Your Honor, because...
Right, those are two different things. Yeah. I just want to make sure that the VA actually was able to change what it did, and so that today it is actually giving correct information.
That is correct. It is giving correct information today. The problem identified in the petition was able to be resolved quite quickly for claims being adjudicated going forward. February 14th, 2019 onward is when we were able to update our information technology template and fix that problem.
Where is the Secretary on the notice to those who were erroneously informed?
Well, there's three sort of, as noted in the declaration, there's three different groups of people who are affected here. The Category A group, which Mr. Borchinger himself is a part of, were denied for the wrong reason. Issuance of those notices started in April 2019, advising them of the mistake. Those claims will all be reopened and re-adjudicated with the one-year appeal period being reset. The Category B group, which Dr. Matthews defines in the declaration, are veterans that were denied for a totally unrelated reason to having other health insurance.
Go back to A. You started notifying them. When will that be accomplished?
Issuance of the letter started in April 2019. All letters will be, mailing will be complete by the end of May, advising them of the mistake.
Right.
Then the claims will be reopened and adjudicated,
right,
re-adjudicated with the one-year appeal period,
right,
reset.
Now back to B.
The B group are claimants that were denied for reasons unrelated to having other health insurance. For example, if the care was not emergency care or they didn't submit their claim timely. But at the bottom of those letters, it had bad boilerplate that referred to the pre-stop version of the regulation. So for those claims, new letters will be, corrected denial notices will be sent in May 2019, and the one-year appeal period will be reset for those claimants as well.
And when will that process be completed, the process of notification?
Well, I know the process of notification will begin in May 2019. I don't have an end date for that group.
Has it begun? I mean,
letters have been drafted, certainly, and approved by VHA and the OGC Healthcare Law Group, and they're, it's quite a substantial amount of veterans impacted.
How many?
For the Category A group, it's 42,000 veterans.
B?
220, close to 221,000.
I assume you're, I didn't mean to interrupt you, I assume you're coming to the C group.
Well, the C group is a little bit different because those are claims that were incomplete and haven't been adjudicated at all. When the veteran was told that their claim was incomplete, missing information, usually it's the explanation of benefits that VA has to obtain from the private or government health insurance to determine what the private or government health insurance is paying so we can determine what our liability is. That's typically what the missing information is. Those rejected notes, so the claims are rejected as incomplete pending receipt of that information. There's 348,000. Well, individual veterans, because, Your Honor, whenever anybody has an episode of care in an emergency room, it generates multiple claims. Mr. Borchinger himself had 14 claims associated with his 10-day episode of care. The facility fee is covered by Medicare Part A. That's the bulk of the cost, $56,000. But he also had 13 different ancillary claims for lab work, radiology charges, an ambulance charge, prescription charges, and VA paid for him, for those ancillary claims, $4,156.20.
What was the total of the ancillary claims?
$4,156.
No, the total of the claims he made, the 11.
14 claims associated with his 10-day period of treatment. And he coordinated his care with the VA.
He asked for the total. You said he was given $4,000, reimbursed $4,000?
He was reimbursed the providers. The providers of care. $4,156.20 for the 13 ancillary claims. The 14th claim is the facility charge, which was $56,771.78. Medicare Part A covered the vast majority of that, and he was left with $1,340 as his patient responsibility as a cost share.
Does there exist anywhere examples of A, B, and C boilerplate letters
The
court could have if we asked?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please supply us.
Okay.
I assume you can do that by the end of the day.
I don't know if I can do that by
the end. Why not? They're form letters. They're on a computer somewhere, I presume. You've got 500,000 people involved here.
Well, Your Honor,
What would be the reason why you couldn't go back to the office and press three buttons and come out with A, B, and C as the letters that the VA, starting in April for A and B, by the way, what about the C group? Have
C
you
group
started sending those letters out?
They've drafted those letters and those letters.
Have they gone out to anybody?
They're going out this month is when that process will begin.
So none have gone yet?
The C group, none have gone yet.
All right. So what's the problem with going back, it's now 11:20, and having to the court by the end of the day examples of A, B, and C letters?
Well, Your Honor, we can get copies of A, B, and C letters to the court today. I just, logistically, would that be a response to a court order, for purposes of filing? What are we responding to? We don't have authority to respond to anything in this case. The petitioner filed their petition.
I'm asking you to do it. You can refuse, you can comply, you can take an appeal. I'm ordering the secretary to give us examples of letters A, B, and C by close of business today.
Okay, then that will be submitted to the court by close of business today.
Thank you. Continue. Add, how much time did you add? Five more minutes at least. Keep going.
Your Honor, Mr. Borschinger is only a member of the Category A group, and the Secretary has taken all action here that he seeks in his petition in terms of relief. The entire class is essentially moot. There's no case or controversy because he doesn't contest the scope, sufficiency, or sincerity of VA's corrective actions. And the court doesn't have jurisdiction to maintain oversight when there's no live case or controversy any longer. And notably, the secretary here has provided more relief to this than the court could order him to provide. In the petition, Mr. Borschinger is asking for the secretary to be enjoined from issuing any more incorrect notices. That's been done. To reissue all communications sent to claimants since the stop decision, which incorrectly stated the criteria. That's in process, and to order the secretary to reset deadlines, which we're doing. The additional relief that the petitioner is asking for is for the secretary to be ordered to invalidate all administrative decisions that denied reimbursement for the incorrect reasons and to re-adjudicate those claims. And the secretary is doing that, but he's doing that because he's a fiduciary to the nation's veterans, not because the court has the authority to order the secretary to re-adjudicate all of these administrative decisions. This was...
I just asked one question. It struck me, and it may not make any difference practically down the road, but for these claims that are now going to be reopened, let's just take the Group A claims as you've described them. They would have all begun under the old system, right? But now they're going to be... Are these people being then forced to be part of the Appeals Modernization Act system, or are they going to be given a choice to proceed under the old system if that's what they would have preferred?
Are you talking about the legacy rule?
Yes, although I find the word legacy
difficult. Well, no, but they keep using
right.
it.
Wait, no, and I understand it. Right. The system that, I think you understand what I'm saying, the system prior to February 19th, right. 2019.
Your Honor, I think that these claims would, since this was the group of claims that were held pending the stop appeal and then adjudicated after the interim final rule was issued in January 2018, these veterans would have the choice of which road they would like to take.
So are you committing that as the position of the secretary? Because I just want you seemed a little bit surprised by the question. I understand that. Who would have thought where it was? But I if what you're telling me is the position of the secretary, which is the people in Group A will have a choice. They can be adjudicated under the old system, the legacy system, in which the duty to assist exists, you know, time immemorial, for example, or they can opt in to elect to have their system be, or their claim be treated as part of the Appeals Modernization Act. If that's the public position of the secretary, then I'm satisfied.
I think that that's the position of the secretary. I would like to confirm that. I believe that the duty to assist would apply to all of the Group A
Well, they would at the beginning, right? So clearly, even under the Appeals Modernization Act, as I understand it, at the initial adjudication, the duty to assist applies. But any time after that, it doesn't, right?
Right.
Right. So I would appreciate it, subject to the other members of the panel, if the secretary could, in some short period of time, let us know. And maybe that's in the letter, for all I know. Right, but that I think is an important point.
Okay.
Because the reason being is, in theory, if we just re-adjudicate the claims, other than lost time, which we can't fix because you know we don't have a time machine, they're going to be in the same procedural position. But if they're being forced into a system that didn't exist at the time their claims were wrongfully denied under this basis, then I think there's an issue.
Okay. Well, the duty to assist would at least initially require the secretary to assist the veterans by obtaining the explanation of benefits, of course, because that's the most important document for VA to determine what our liability is and what based on what the private insurer is paying.
Why don't you do your best to supply the answer to Judge Allen's question? And while you're getting the three letters that I've requested by the end of the day today, take a look. Maybe it does contain the information that he's suggesting. All right?
Yes, we will.
Keep going.
Your Honor, the petitioner is asking for a class to be certified, but the fact that as we've been discussing here today, there's three separate categories, separate and distinct categories of veterans that are impacted by the different notices, some that were denied for the wrong reason.
Take another 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Some that were denied for the wrong reason, like Mr. Borschinger and the rest of Group A, some that were denied for the right reason but got bad notice, the B group, and some that weren't denied at all, their claims were just rejected as incomplete. The fact that the three separate groups exist at all and need to be remedied in different ways undercuts the argument that class certification is warranted, because for class certification, commonality is the crux of the issue.
Well, why don't we apply the Justice Ginsburg approach? The things that make the group common, or the things that connect the group, rather than the things that put them apart.
Well, Your Honor, in Monk, this court said specifically that for class certification, there has to be common questions and common answers. And here, the mistake is common. For the A group, they were all denied for the wrong reason. But even within the A group, the remedy is not common. All these claims are going to be reopened, and every claim will be re-adjudicated and will present different issues as the secretary assists in developing those claims by obtaining the explanation of benefits.
But if we order a class, if we certify a class, it's going to be supervised by this court. We're not going to leave it to the secretary to make these decisions.
Your Honor, the first step in certifying the class would be defining the class. And Mr. Borschinger's petition defines a class that's overly broad.
That's your argument.
It is our argument, yes.
Right.
But the vast majority of the claimants encompassed by his class definition, he's not even part of those groups. He was denied for the wrong reason, yes. His claim's been re-adjudicated, and the rest of his Category A members will also be re-adjudicated. But for him, we could re-adjudicate his claim because we had his explanation of benefits. For the other members of his group, VA has to develop those claims and contact the providers and contact the veteran individually to obtain the explanation of benefits so that we can adjudicate the claim. That has to be done individually for every claim.
I understand.
So to the extent the relief has been provided, the Secretary's position is that with no live case or controversy, the entire class claim is moot. And alternatively, if the court did not agree that that petition had been mooted, all of the petitioners in the Group A category, well, even in Group B, will have an adequate alternative means to obtain the relief they seek because their claims are going to be reopened and re-adjudicated, and they will be able to appeal.
Anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Any question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Blocker. If you need more time, we took a lot of time with both counsel, so if you need more than your 7 minutes, just feel free to continue until we stop you.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'm going to start with the Borschinger class. So the dispute in the papers is about what to do with the Borschinger class. And you know, obviously, we think a class should be certified. We've articulated the class that should be certified. We appreciate the Secretary's efforts to date and that this is on the road to correction. But Judge Greenberg, you hit the nail right on the head. If you certify a class, the benefit of doing that is that any action by the Secretary will be supervised by this court. We made this clear in our papers, and I'll just update you. We reached out to the Secretary after we filed our reply brief to ask, to inquire whether we could agree on a form of a consent judgment, but the Secretary turned us down. And I frankly don't understand why the Secretary in this instance would be allergic to having a class be certified, because it seems like the simplest path for the Secretary to certify a class, agree everybody's going to be swept in, and to cleanse this problem once and for all to the satisfaction of this court. We don't know anything other than what's in the affidavit that they have attached to their response brief. We really don't know anything about the efforts that are being made. We don't know what the letters look like.
Has your client gotten a letter?
And not that it's been forwarded to me, and I don't think she would have received one yet because I'm not sure in which group she would have.
No, Borschinger. It could be Ms. Wolf, but Mr. Borschinger, which I was trying to avoid saying that because I was going to mangle it, but do you know whether he has gotten a letter?
I do not know the answer to that, Judge Allen. If he's received one, certainly I should know that, but I just standing here, I don't.
What makes you think that having the court supervise the Secretary's remedial action would be an efficient process where in February or March they became aware of the issue, they immediately began corrective action, they're well on the way to accomplishing corrective action, and here we are, months from an opinion probably that will say something. If cases like SCORE are any indication, Monk, could be a year-long process before we get to supervising anything, if we ever get there. What's wrong with what they're doing and letting them to it?
Well, I want to separate those two. I mean, as I said, we appreciate the efforts the Secretary is making because this is on its way to correction. But you heard counsel say some of these letters are in the works, that there's no outer deadline for each one of the groups. What we envision is entry of some sort of consent judgment that would provide some blessing for whatever templates the Secretary is going to use and would set some firm deadlines for the parties, for the VA to accomplish that and to send out all the letters. And just to have all the understandings between the petitioner who's seeking class status and the VA set in a single document that everybody can look to see. I'm not talking about actual supervision with the court's involvement. I'm talking about if Mr. Borschinger thought that the edicts of the consent judgment were being carried out, we could come back to this court.
Well, why not sit down and
now, the way it stands now, what we'll be left with is if you don't certify a class and you just let the VA carry on, you know, we don't have any means to address. We'd have to file a new action if there was some issue that was raised with respect to either the letters that they were sending out or the timeframes in which they were doing it. So again, I think Judge Greenberg's point's the right way to look at this, which is, and maybe it's the wrong word, it would be supervised by the court in the sense that the parties could come back to the court and say, we don't think your consent judgment is being carried out. Please, you know, take some form of action. And again, I don't know why the secretary in this circumstance wouldn't want that. That everybody wants the same thing here. We want these claims to be re-adjudicated. We want letters to go out that are correct. Everybody wants the same thing. It's not a claim that is moot. It's a claim that's ripe for a consent judgment.
Well, maybe the secretary wants to, without the court editing its templates, exercise his authority as the a coordinate branch of government.
This is what happens all the time in class actions. Plaintiffs, a group of
indeed,
come in and seek certification and seek a specific ends. But more to your point, Judge Falvey, if the petitioners agreed the letters were appropriate and the VA had written the letters in a way that we thought was appropriate, it seems like the VA's maximum benefit here would be to certify a class and to cleanse this issue rather than to have people nipping at their heels saying, well, we don't think these letters are any good, or we don't think the timeframes are, you know, you did it too slowly. We would agree on some sort of timeframes to have this all be accomplished. So it is appropriate, and it's not moot. We went through this in the Monk case. This is the same argument that the VA tried in Monk. They tried to raise his rating schedule up to 100% and then argued the claim was moot. This court rejected that. The Federal Circuit rejected that as well, saying, no, it's not moot because at the end of the day, this is something that's likely to recur. And you have the same thing here. Mr. Borschinger had jurisdiction, had a live claim at the time, and this is something that certainly fits the Monk doctrine of capable of repetition but evading review. So,
but
you think you should?
It's not. It's different than Monk. Monk, they solved Monk's issue. Here they're solving all of Class A, B, and C's issue.
Right, but again, they're seeking to, the argument is whether there is still a live controversy, right? And so the question is, at the time that Mr. Borschinger filed joined the petition, was there a live claim? And that's all that matters. They can't moot it by deciding what sort of action they're going to take. It's not all the actions that we've asked them to take by counsel's admission. They're unwilling to take certain of the actions. But again, this, it seems to me, could be handled through a consent judgment, and the problem would hopefully go away. I want to, if I've answered your question, I wanted to go back to the part of the claim that relates to Ms. Wolf and address a couple of counsel's comments.
And when you do that, could you also address the fact that if, I wrote this down, but my handwriting is bad, so it looks like the VA has reimbursed, for example, Mr. B, a little over $4,000.
Yes.
So that suggests that there are things in the world that are reimbursable that are other than co-payments, co-insurance, and deductibles.
So let me start right there, because that's actually where I wanted to start.
I think that's an important point.
It actually is not, Judge Allen, and let me explain why. What we're talking about is that person, for those specific services that are being provided to that veteran, that veteran is in the exact same circumstance as a veteran who has no insurance, okay? So if you imagine that the veteran, think of the way the services were provided as I have insurance for some of the services and I don't have insurance for all the others. Of course, VA would pay for the services that are uninsured by anybody.
And is this sort of like trying to think of one off the top of my head, maybe an ambulance service or something? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, or I guess they're using the example of Medicare, and Part A covers certain things and it doesn't cover certain things. But for the other things that Medicare Part A doesn't cover, the veteran is in exactly the same circumstance of being uninsured as any veteran who had no insurance at all, right? So it's, to me, it's more like, it's almost sleight of hand, because what you're saying is, well, here's a service for which the veteran has absolutely no insurance, and look, now we pay. Oh, that was the circumstance that should have existed all along. Now what they're saying is, well, but if the veteran has insurance for any covered service, so any service that's covered by their private insurance, your insurance is going to pay, and if there's deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance, in Ms. Wolf's case, $2,400 worth, we're not paying any of that because we wrote the regulations so we wouldn't have to pay any of it.
So to just so I have this straight in my head, if you were going to be articulating this, you might say that the distinction here is that for any service for which a veteran has coverage but is subject to some type of cost-sharing mechanism, the regulation as adopted by VA zeroes that out in terms of reimbursement, meaning there's nothing left for which a check can be written because co-payments, co-insurance, and deductibles takes care of everything. And then you have these other things for which there's no insurance at all. That's what gets reimbursed.
Correct. And so it's not that, to our earlier conversation, it's not that there is no other thing out there. What we are talking about is what services are insured and what other payments are out there in the world that could be the responsibility of a veteran who has insurance for those sort of services. The only thing I would quibble with in your summary, which I think is largely an accurate summary of my position, is, you know, counsel kept using the word cost-sharing exclusion. It's not a, and Judge Greenberg, I think, pointed this out, it's not a cost-sharing exclusion. It's a co-payment exclusion. They've interpreted it to be cost-sharing. But if you look on pages 18 and 19 of the Secretary's brief, you'll see a bunch of statutes where courts have, where Congress has said, has excluded everything that's cost-sharing or defined it as cost-sharing and then included everything under that rubric. That's not what 1725C4D does.
And I take that. The point that I was getting at, and this gets back to something we discussed at the beginning, and then I also discussed with Mr. Bader, is now I'm uncertain about the statistics that might exist in terms of reimbursement, because I would be interested in, and I'm not asking anybody to give me this, but I would be interested in how much money has actually been reimbursed under the terms of this regulation from the VA's perspective as covering all cost sharing.
Yes.
Right? Because if we say X millions of dollars have been reimbursed, it may be that they're all reimbursed for services for which there's no insurance at all. And that's the distinction that I had not appreciated.
Well, logically, I would think that would have to be the case. I mean, you asked me the question about what was the $12 for, and you and I couldn't think of anything that would cover. And with counsel's clarification, I think what they may be talking about now is now we are paying for services that we should have been paying for all along that were uninsured. The question before this court is what of the services that are insured, what should be paid? So I wanted to address another question, though, that you asked, Judge Allen, that had to do with futility and the question of adequate alternative remedy. And you said, is there a futility exception? And let me address that in two ways. First of all, if I had no case at all to support me, I would say there should be a futility exception because by its nature, this is equitable relief. And if you're seeking equitable relief, it can't be the case that your adequate alternative remedy is something that is going to be a useless act. And so just as a matter of equity, there should be some sort of futility exception, but you don't even have to go there to do that. There's a case that we cited in our reply brief, called Esprimer versus Derwinski. It's
an early case from this court.
Correct. It's actually in the reporter. It's in the first volume. And if you look on page 11, it's what we cited. But it specifically says that adequate alternative relief can't mean an act that is a useless act. And applied to this case, there's no question that having veterans go through the board process, the agency and then board process is going to be a useless act because counsel finally admitted to you that there's no question there about what's going to happen. The veteran's claim for a co-payment, a deductible, or a co-insurance is going to be denied. So when you talk about adequate alternative remedy, what you're really saying is they should go through the useless act, and it's going to take 5 years to get back up to this court. But We think that's an adequate alternative remedy. No case says that. The cases that talk about appeals and Cheney is, you know, the Supreme Court decision, and Cheney is a perfect example. They're talking about instances where appeal is imminent. There's going to be some appeal, and the idea is not to just have things go piecemeal back and forth, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a regulation that is going to apply to all veterans during that five-year period. And I frankly think, if you think about it logically, and I think if the VA thought hard about this, the VA ought to want to have this issue addressed now, because what we're going to do is, if they wait the 5 years and it turns out the regulation is invalid, there's going to be 5 years worth of claims that need to be re-adjudicated on a docket that's already, by everybody's agreement, clogged. So why not fix that now so the VA isn't engaging in useless acts, veterans aren't engaging in useless acts? There clearly is a futility exception under the Espermer decision, so you can apply that. But even if Espermer didn't say exactly what I'm saying, you can, as a matter of equity, that's the appropriate way to go. The last point I'll make, so I don't overstay my welcome, is, you know, the issue about payment versus payments. We cited in our brief another statute that applies to disability claims. It's 38 U.S.C. 1729. And if you look at 1729A3, it specifically says that the secretary does not have to reimburse. It can exclude from its payments co-payments and deductibles. And what should you take from that? You should take away from that that when Congress meant for something other than co-payments to be excluded from its payments, it knew how to say that. But that's not what it said in 1725C4D. It said co-payment or similar payment, which both parties agree the similar payment was there for regulatory flexibility, and that's the sole reason it's there. Which, and we're not making a quantitative versus qualitative argument. What we're saying is that the term or similar payment was meant to relate to what co-payment was. And so that if an insurance company called it something else, but it was the $20 that Judge Allen had to take out of his pocket to go see his doctor, that's what we were talking about. And so, you know, that statute, 1729A3, it's not responded to in the Secretary's brief. When you look, you'll see there's no response to that. In conclusion, Your Honor, we think the appropriate outcome here is to certify the what I'll call the Wolf class and invalidate the regulation and accord the other relief that we have requested in our amended petition. And as to the Borschinger class, as I said, we remain willing to negotiate a consent judgment so that that issue can be taken care of and everybody can have certainty that the issue related to the templates and cutters is taken care of. So thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you. The case is submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel.